Hello, welcome to the Big Web Show. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is my very special guest, Jerry Cody, an illustrator and designer at Hello Jerry. She's Hello Jerry on the Twitters, and she's the author of Color Accessibility Workflows, new from A Book Apart. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you. So you're originally from Newfoundland, right?
Yes, I am.
St. John's?
Yes.
Been there a couple times. Rugged place.
Yes, you have.
The telegraph was invented there, I believe. Or the first telegraph.
Yeah, Marconi and the first wireless signal. So, I mean, a big, important part of international communication, which is pretty cool.
And where we are today, right, without wireless communication and international telecommunications, we wouldn't have worked our way to the internet.
Exactly.
Where you draw pictures and design stuff.
Yes,
and
I
write
do.
Books. Your site, Hello Jerry, is beautiful. You have a really nice blog. I'm thrilled that you keep blogging. A lot of people have given up. And your blog posts are pretty to look at. They're well written. They always have nice illustrations. Site layout's great. How do you stay inspired as a blogger?
Well, I will admit that I've not been very good at it lately, but it is mainly because I'm actually working on another blog, which is a side project, which isn't ready yet. But I think that, you know, I started out in this industry by kind of blogging. So it's a lot of people will ask me things like, you know, what's the best way to get into the industry or start speaking or that kind of thing. And it always comes back to just blogging, you know. And I find that if you have a topic that you want to talk about, just start blogging about it. Even if nobody really reads it or just a few people read it, I think that's enough to kind of keep you inspired. And if you can help somebody by what you write, I think that is inspiration enough. So I will get better at it, but I do like it.
I agree with you. It obviously, it's been very helpful to me too. There's that when people start, and we'll get into writing because you've just written a book, but this is a good place to start talking about writing. Writing's not the main thing you do, right? You're an artist, illustrator, designer. But you got into it. How do you get past, I think for a lot of people, the initial period where they're blogging and nobody's reading can be very, very daunting. How did you get past that?
That is definitely one of the main concerns because I think, you know, like you said, there's a lot of people where, you know, you could just write an amazing blog and just amazing blog posts every day, and trying to connect with people is really difficult. But I guess, you know, if you're writing quality content, maybe try to put your own spin on it, you know, not just kind of rehash the same things that people say over and over. And I feel like if you can bring something unique, and it doesn't even have to be in the content, it could be in just the way that it's presented. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like when I started my blog, I really knew that I wanted to feature illustration quite a bit. And my new blog, my new side project, which is not out yet, which has nothing to do with web design. It's just a personal kind of venture for me. It's going to be primarily an illustrated blog. So if you have that kind of ability to bring your own personal touch to it, I think that is one way to kind of help set yourself apart from everybody else. So you just kind of have to, you know, and you have to invest the time in it and hope that it works. And if you can be unique, I think that's really helpful.
That is a great point, and I'm very eager to see that book because I love your art. I'm very eager to see that blog because I love your art. But another thing that I was thinking is that if you're learning and writing about what you're learning, to me it always makes it feel fresh and automatically puts a new slant on it. Like if I were to sit down right now and write about basic HTML, mm-hmm. I would turn out a very dull blog. Because that's not a new subject for me. What, you know, when I was learning HTML and writing about it, it was very exciting to me. And I probably got some stuff wrong, and that didn't really matter in the long run either.
Absolutely. So the blog actually that I'm working on is a side project. I guess you could kind of think of it as a similar thing, because it is kind of about my love for Japan and Japanese travels, and also learning the language as well. So, you know, I'm going to be talking a lot about, you know, how my progress throughout the language goes, which obviously can be compared to, you know, what you're talking about, like when you started out with HTML. So talking about what you learn at the time of learning is so helpful, not just for yourself, because you're kind of reinforcing what you're learning at the same time and you're keeping it fresh in your head, but you know, you're also helping people who might be a little bit too embarrassed to ask questions as a beginner. And I feel like these days in the web design and web development industry, like in our industry, things are so advanced and things are changing so much. Like, I would not want to be a beginner right now, because I'm not a beginner, and yet I feel like a beginner, because if you just take your eye off the ball for a moment, like, you've lost pretty much everything. So I think, you know, talking about what you're learning, even if you've just taken a break for a year and you want to get back into it, or a couple of years, I think it helps other people, because, you know, they're not going to feel alone and they're not going to feel like they have stupid beginner questions.
That's a great
point. Everybody
has
to start somewhere.
Yeah, I think also the perspective of someone coming back after a break, like when someone's been on maternity leave and they come back and the work experience feels different. They blog about that. That's a wonderful topic. People relate to it, feel less alone, and it's a different perspective on work.
Exactly.
Where you're coming from is part of the story. It's Heisenberg. Right? You change it by observing. I don't know if that's actually Heisenberg. That could be my big misunderstanding of Heisenberg. But one of the things I always thought it meant was, when you observe something, you by the fact that you participate, you're changing it.
Yeah. I just think it's just a great tactic, and I think everybody has something unique that they can bring to their writing or blogging or speaking on stage, and I think that's the kind of thing that you can do to just be a little bit more unique and interesting, and let other, you know, allow other people to be able to relate to you more. You know, there's so many people out there with different experiences and different backgrounds, and, you know, especially in this industry where so many of us have not been formally trained because of the nature of the industry itself. It's like, I always find it really interesting to hear people's stories of how they got into web design.
I would like to hear yours, but I'd like to start with drawing. You actually have crayon drawings on HelloJerry.com. You have crayon drawings from when you were very little.
Yes, I do. I can't believe you found them.
So there's a wonderful, I mean, the road from that to what you do now. And the many, you know, the sort of the house style that you have, the very definite style that you have, but your ability to work in other styles as well, and you know, depending on what, I guess, what the client needs. A pretty remarkable journey. How did you, you were just always drawing?
Yeah, I guess, like, you know, ever since I was a kid, I guess my mom and my dad, but mostly my mom, she would, you know, draw with me, and I just loved it. I loved it so much. And I think around the time of high school, when I entered high school, I went to a new high school, and one of the things that was quite well known about my high school was that we had our own art gallery, which I thought was very cool. And we had one of the best art programs in the city, and I just tried to do as many art programs as I could, and that was when I got heavily into, you know, building websites in GeoCities and that kind of thing as well. So once I got my computer, I think that was really when my digital kind of illustration was my interest in that was sparked because it just opened up like a whole new world for, as a medium. Because before that, it was just pencils and pastels and anything that like a young teen or like a 12-year-old would do. So I loved it, and I just wanted to learn how to do everything at that point, making websites,
What were you
making.
using then for your illustrations? Illustrator?
Back then, I would have started in
Paint?
Microsoft Paint. Yeah, I mean, that would have been the first thing around probably 1996, 1997. And when I got my own computer, I think I discovered PaintShop Pro, which was much more accessible to people back then because Photoshop was obviously targeted towards professionals. And you couldn't just, find a copy that fell off a truck.
Right. Well, people did.
So, yes,
Actually,
that's right.
someone who used to be at Adobe, and I won't mention names, told me in confidence the only thing that made them sad about shifting to the cloud-based model was that people weren't going to be able to steal their first copy of Photoshop anymore, which I found a kind of a but they were sincere because what they meant is it's kind of like the first bag of crack is free. I don't, do they sell crack in bags? Maybe they sell it in vials. I don't know. I missed crack, but once you have a tool that powerful, you kind of can't give it up. So, and
Exactly.
it's sort of like everybody stole. Well, forgive me. Everybody stole their first fonts, and then and now we're all very like, oh no. Someone else is going to use this. I have to buy another
Yeah.
copy. We're all, we do the
Yeah,
right
that's
thing,
right.
or like the first. I remember, wow, this is a confession now. But like, I remember stealing music in the mid '90s, and then and people stole
Yeah.
music to demonstrate that there was a market for it, and then people figured out how to sell it for 99 cents and or
Exactly.
streaming, and now that works.
Yeah, I feel like, the limitations of the technology and the fact that, the internet in its fairly early days when people started to really get computers in their homes, like, the late 90s and early 2000s and when Napster came along and all that stuff, it's like everybody was, downloading copies of software and Photoshop, and I mean, people still do, but companies have also learned how to make it more accessible and how to actually make customers want to pay for it. It just feels different now. And I think most people who got into this industry probably did steal copies of software, but
Something or other, yeah.
of something in fonts, like you said. And back then, I think the understanding around things like fonts and typefaces, nobody really understood. I think people still don't understand how much work goes into them, but
Right.
you would really never think twice about just downloading thousands of fonts and using them. But, I
Well, I
think
think
people's
the industry
perceptions are changing.
devalued them too. I remember I bought my first Mac was a clone, right? So I bought during the clone era, and I think it was called PC from Power Computing, and it
Right.
was a nice beige machine. It was a Mac, but like they did kind of what people do with Windows, right? They or did with Windows. They gave away all kinds of extra software, and one of the things they gave you was like 2,000 fonts on a disk.
Yeah.
And how many of those were good fonts? I don't know. I like actually, if you'd given someone like three good fonts and explained how to use them, that would be much more useful. But of course, I went nuts with that, like everybody does. I was like, oh wow, look at this. It's so, what's, I don't know the word for it, but it's really squeezed. Yeah, I like that squeezed look. That looks like a club flyer I saw. And you know what? Playing with that stuff, it's how you get where you end up. I mean, that's what we had for training. We had experimentation. Did you study art in that university or?
I went to a college which I'm not really sure how it would relate or how it would compare to colleges and stuff in America, because it's a little different. But my college was a public trade and technology college, so I did graphic design program there.
Oh, nice.
And I also did a program called graphic production, which basically taught everything about printing and printing processes, so lithography, offset lithography. We were very fortunate because it was a public college funded by the government that we had quite a lot of fantastic equipment. So we had giant printing presses. Every student in the class, it was quite small, like about 16 students per class. You know, we had access to print our own printing plates and, you know, put them on the press and print whatever we wanted. So I learned a lot about the print side of design, and that program that I did in college was primarily print design focused, and, you know, with a bit of like advertising and that sort of thing. Just a couple of digital media courses, but not really that many.
So first of all, yay Canada. Canada's awesome. A country that wants to educate its people and makes that affordable, pretty great. I wish every wealthy country had the same, you know, had that same feeling toward its citizens, but that is great. How did you, so I just wanted to thank Canada, how did you, because you might not be you without that, and then a million things that I take for granted on the web, including some beautiful list of part illustrations you've done, just wouldn't even exist, and that would be sad. how did you make the transition into digital and web?
Well, it kind of went back and forth. So originally, when I did get my computer in high school, like I said, the first thing I wanted to do when I got my computer was to learn how to make a website. So that would have been around 1998, maybe 1997. I can't quite remember. So that was something I just, you know, taught myself HTML. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing because I was just like 14 or 15 or something. And I really enjoyed it because it was so simple. And throughout high school, I did a few competitions called Skills Canada, and I know that there are similar competitions in America called Skills USA. And I like to kind of refer to it as the Nerd Olympics. So basically, there's like all kinds of different competitions. There's graphic design, web design, automotive, floristry, hairstyling, like anything that's like a trade or technology is generally a competition area. So throughout high school, I focused on the web design competition, and I won a couple of those. I was very lucky to win a couple. And I did a couple of small client websites when I was first in college. But once I got into print design, I kind of left the web stuff behind because at that point, things started to get a little bit more complicated. And I didn't really want to get into things like JavaScript and more complicated side of things when really I just cared about HTML and CSS. I wanted to kind of focus on the design side of things, so it kind of slipped away from me. And eventually, when I graduated college, I did get a job in... there was a couple of little jobs I had, but then I went to an advertising agency where I primarily
worked... Still in Newfoundland, right?
Yes, yeah. Where I primarily worked in print design, in advertising, all that kind of thing. So that was my main role at that company. But because we were a full-service agency, we would always get clients coming in and asking for websites too. And I kind of wasn't very excited about it because I kind of thought I would be the one to have to get back into making websites when I really enjoyed print design. But I realized it was ridiculous for me to rely on print design for the rest of my career. And I'm like, I'm still young. This is crazy. It's only going to get more and more, you know, the iPhone was out at that point and things were going crazy. I started hearing things about like responsive design and I was like, this is interesting. This is pretty cool. So I realized, you know, I needed to get back into it. And I did a little search online thinking, you know, maybe I could see if there were any conferences that I could go to kind of get back in, because I felt so behind. I think before that, I was probably making table layouts. That was the last time I kind of made websites using things like Dreamweaver and all that kind of thing. And I came across an event apart. And
oh, really?
And that was it. I was like, this conference looks amazing. And I had my boss, I showed my boss, and he thought it was a great idea. So he sent me to Boston. And that just went from there. So,
like 2007, something like that? 2008?
I actually think it was, 2010.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Had you really heard about responsive design before?
It was...
Yeah.
I believe that Ethan actually launched his article on the day that he did his talk at the conference in Boston, if I remember
That's
correctly.
That's correct.
So I was there at the conference when he revealed that, which was
history.
A pretty cool, yeah. Pretty cool event to be at. So yeah. I think I was very lucky I picked the
May,
right one.
May 25th, 2010.
Mm. That's it.
The birth of responsive web design.
Yeah. And it just fascinated me, you know, like that did, obviously, as you know, that changed the world.
Yeah.
And
did you like it as a designer? Were you like, oh, this is it? This is what I've been looking for?
I thought it was amazing because, you know, it was done in CSS and done in media queries. And it was done in a way that was not difficult for me and many other people to understand. It wasn't like, you know, I dabbled in the thought of maybe being a developer a long time ago until I realized that that was not really what I should be doing if I was good at illustration and design. Mm-hmm. But there was just something like when Ethan talked about responsive design, I realized how big and how important that was going to be. And, you know, when I went back to my agency and talked to my boss and talked to my team, I was like, you know, this is something we have to get on top of. And, you know, he was right, obviously. So that really got me back into web design for sure. And I think today I still don't really do that much in terms of web design on my own. I kind of prefer to focus on illustration and the artwork side of things, but I really like to do things from like a direction standpoint. So I like to work with a team of developers, work on style guides, help people get that kind of thing done for their brand. And I just think that I'm very happy learning what I've learned about responsive design and understanding how all these things work, that, you know, I know enough to be able to work with developers very well, especially coming from a mainly print design background where, you know, you get a lot of print designers who really don't understand the capabilities or the limitations of the web. So I like to kind of use that to my advantage, I think, when I work with other teams.
That is really cool. I am coming around to a similar point of view. Because front-end development has shot past me as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about that. And yet, somehow, you're an authority who has written a book on accessibility. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. But first, I need to thank one of our very fine sponsors. So please allow me to do that. This episode of The Big Web Show is brought to you by SendPro from Pitney Bowes. Pitney Bowes are the people. I can remember my dad in his office having a Pitney Bowes machine. And I was like, well, what's that? And he said, well, I can mail stuff without going to the post office. And I just thought that was, what? That was crazy. How could you mail stuff without going to the post? But so Pitney Bowes have been in business doing this a long time. SendPro, their latest product, has 3 times the features of stamps.com at 1/3 the price. Basically what happens, you sit there at your computer and you print stamps. You print stamps from your computer, saving you time and money. And you don't need any special equipment. You don't have to wait in line at the post office. You don't have to soak in the deep ambience of the post office. You also, with SendPro, you can compare shipping rates and delivery times between the post office and other major carriers to make sure you always get the best deal when you ship packages. You can print shipping labels for the U.S. Post Office, UPS, and more. Track your shipments from the same interface, which is very easy to use, just a dashboard. We all are familiar with those. And Pitney Bowes has negotiated special rates for SendPro users. They actually went to the government and said, we'd like people who buy this equipment to be able to save on postage. And the government said, okay. And currently, savings start at 3 cents per stamp, but they can go lower and will go lower. Businesses can even mail now and pay later with flexible payment options. So if your client hasn't paid you and you're broke, but you still need to send them an invoice, you can send them an invoice, even though you can't pay for the stamp that does it until later. That's a very depressing scenario, but anyone who freelances will understand immediately what I'm talking about, or runs a studio. Anyway, if you want to get in on some of this action, and why wouldn't you? If you ever need to mail anything from the post office or send anything from any major carrier, why wouldn't you do this? Visit pb.com/bigwebshow to learn more. That's pb.com/bigwebshow. Go there, and when you sign up, you'll get SendPro free for 90 days. You'll also get a free 10-pound scale, so you can weigh stuff before you send it and know how much postage it should have or how much it will cost. When your free trial is over, you'll get SendPro for only $5 a month. And that special rate is good for the lifetime of your SendPro subscription. So basically, if you live 1,000 years and everything costs $1 million just for a loaf of bread, you'll still be paying $5 a month for SendPro. And you're probably not going to live that long. Again, I'm getting into depressing territory. I'm sorry. It's just how my mind works. But I think it's pretty cool. I'm old enough to have seen money get devalued already, and I imagine it will continue to get devalued in our lifetimes. But $5 a month will seem like even less and less as time goes on. By the way, that $5 a month for SendPro is versus $15.99 a month for stamps.com. So that's 3 times the features for 1/3 the price. But you can also only get this deal for a limited time by going to pb.com/bigwebshow. That's pb.com/bigwebshow to take advantage of this incredible offer. Pitney Bowes are masters in the craft of making your business succeed. And we thank SendPro for sponsoring the Big Web Show. And now we are back with Hello, Jerry. Hello, Jerry. Jerry Cody, author of Color Accessibility Workflows from A Book Apart, and designer at designer at Hello, Jerry. Hi.
Hi.
We're back. Not that we ever actually went away, but, you know, that's what they say. We are back. So let's talk about your book. First of all, what got you? It's unusual for visual artists to be especially interested in accessibility and for visual designers to be especially interested in accessibility. So just there's this notion that accessibility and aesthetics must, you know, must be incompatible. I know I've heard this forever. I can't make it accessible because I want it to look good. So that's a load of hooey.
It sure is.
How did you get involved in accessibility and interested?
Well, I think I was very lucky because talking about my college days when I did my graphic design program, very fortunately, one of my design teachers, who was also, he's primarily a photographer, but he also taught us some other courses about design theory and all that kind of thing. And he was colorblind. So he was a colorblind photographer. And I actually didn't know that until maybe second year or so of college. And after I graduated, and once I started to kind of get interested in colorblindness and how people who are affected by colorblindness, perceive the world, I remembered my teacher, and I dropped him a line, and I talked to him about it, and I talked about his experiences with it. And it was just fascinating to me because it's the kind of thing that a lot of people don't talk about, and
From
they just,
shame or what?
well, not really from shame, but I mean, some people don't even know that they're colorblind. So, my photography
Really?
teacher, my photography teacher, he told me, like, I have a quote in my book that he said, my design teacher pointed it out to me in my first
That's right.
year at Ryerson University. And he wondered why he could not make color prints as a photographer. So, back then in the dark room and trying to get, like, balance of this color photograph. And the reason why he couldn't do it was because he was colorblind but had no idea. And from that point on, he just kind of focused more on black and white photography, and he became quite well known for that. And I just thought that, that was so fascinating for such a talented photographer to not even know or understand that he was colorblind until somebody else told him about it. And from that point on, I was just fascinated by the topic, and I tried to learn as much about it as I could. And, then I started to learn about other designers in our industry who are colorblind. And I think there's a lot of stigma around it sometimes because in certain industries, where you have to have good color vision and you have to pass tests if you want to work in a lab or, you want to be a pilot or that kind of thing. Like, they make you do these tests, even if in reality you can do your tasks daily without any problem at all. And I was just fascinated by it. And from there, I started to blog about it. I started to do little talks around it, and I wrote a book for Five Simple Steps a few years ago. And
What was the name of that?
that was a pocket guide to color accessibility, which obviously is not available anymore because Five Simple Steps is sadly no more. But
That was very sad.
yeah, it was very sad.
Publishing is hard. I
It
mean,
is. It is. It's very hard, but it was such a great experience. And I think originally I actually wanted to publish my book with a book apart, but I just didn't have the confidence.
oh.
Yeah, but it was like, I had the idea maybe about five years ago or so, and eventually, when these pocket guides from Five Simple Steps came around, I said, well, that's a great way to just kind
Yes.
of put my foot in the door, and that was a really great experience. But then, like, when these A Book Apart briefs came out, I was like, this would be a really good opportunity to just go deeper into the topic, talk more about it, talk about a few different things, like, how to work color accessibility into your workflow, because I feel like there's a lot of designers and developers who might understand what they have to do, but maybe don't really know at which stage they should
Yes,
start
there's
thinking
not a
about
step
accessibility.
necessarily, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a lot of people, I think, are under the assumption that you can just design your website and then at the end run it through a simulator, run it through a contrast checker, or run it through a compliance checker. And, if it passes, then that's great. And if there's some errors, well, we'll just go in and fix those and then we'll push it out. But, it doesn't really work that way because, especially when you get into bigger websites and, for big enterprises and stuff, like, you really need to start thinking about it from the beginning. Like, accessibility, not just color accessibility, but any kind of accessibility, you have to think about it from the beginning, because if you don't, your timeline's just gonna drag, things are gonna happen, people are gonna start cutting it out because, oh, we've run out of time, we've run out of money, we'll just patch it later, and things don't get done. And I think that's why there are so many websites out there who have, problems with accessibility. And it's because they just don't think about it until later. It's an afterthought, and it makes things so much more difficult.
It's a big point in your book, and it's a big point generally. It's a big thing that I've learned is that it's much easier to plan than to retrofix, right? Companies get sued because there's something's inaccessible in their site, and they go, "But I have to," or they don't build with progressive enhancement, and then their site doesn't work without JavaScript, and they're in trouble, probably because of accessibility issues, and they're like, "But it doesn't work without JavaScript. Well, we built this whole thing that way." And it's like, that's sad. And you don't want anyone to be in that position. And often the site owner didn't know any better. And maybe even the developers don't know. Because a lot of people now are, their JavaScript is so powerful and it's so much the language of the day and the web right now that there are really talented, very skilled developers who don't realize it's a thing that a site should work for everyone. It's actually a thing. That's how the web works. And if you plan for it from the very beginning, you won't have a problem, right? And you can
Exactly.
still, if you layer in all that other stuff, you know. So what, talk about some of the, you have a section on tips and tricks. Talk about some of that, like things, an over, like somebody listening to this right now may be overwhelmed because they may be going, "I just launched a site," or "I just finished the site at my job, and we didn't think about this at all." What are some things they can do? Given that it's better to plan for it up front, what are some things people can come in and do, like as a quick fix, for example?
Well, I mean, for quick fixes, you do have things like, simply running your site through a simulator to see if there's anything that it will be picked up on right away. Things like text contrast, if it's too low, that can be an easy fix if it's not too drastic. If your entire website has poor contrast and aesthetically you've designed it to be low contrast, then that could be a little bit more problematic. Or
Right.
if there are different things that you can do. So things that I like.
But oftentimes, if you just like, I work with Robert Jolly a lot, and he'll go in and go, "This is great, but if you darken the type this much and lighten the background just this much, then we're going to be in conformance and it'll be better." Because if you're not colorblind or don't have vision issues, sometimes something can seem like it's working.
It's exactly, because we're designing, everybody kind of designs by default for what their own vision is, but everybody's vision is different. So what you might think looks good, that's the whole thing. Like, you might think it looks great, but other people just simply might not be able to see it at all. And I just think that, at the bare minimum, if your text and your content and your navigation and all that sort of thing is not visible, and the contrast is not high enough, like that, I don't like talking about bare minimums because there's so many more important things as well.
Right.
But, at the bare minimum, you should make sure that your content and your navigation and all the important structure of your website is not low contrast. I mean, I think we are getting better as an industry, and I think people are talking more about low contrast and how it is not good for anybody. It doesn't have to be somebody who's colorblind. It could be for older generation who might just have difficulty. It could be for somebody who's younger who has eyesight problems. They could be looking at it on an iPad with smaller text, and that could be problematic. So there's so many things that you really have to keep in mind, and
Are you familiar with the gray box method?
The gray box
Of
method.
comp of Jason Santamaria wrote about it like 15 years ago.
Yeah, it does ring a
You
bell.
were probably in high school,
I
the idea was that if you're designing something, you don't introduce color. And this is an old design trick. You don't
Oh,
introduce color till the
yeah.
end. So, if you're designing a logo and it's color dependent, then you might have a problem and not realize it. Or if your layout looks great with that big red image on that blue background, it may be too late to realize that you're actually just a particular color combination happened to be working and making it look like it was better designed than it was. And as soon as the client puts the real art in place, it's not going to look that way. So just the simple idea of designing everything in grayscale first. You talked about an experiment by Natalie Dubay.
So she it's a great idea in theory. So it was a student project that I discovered on the internet, and what she did was she took colored pencils that normally would have just the color on the painted coating on the outside of the pencil, so like red, orange, green, all that sort of thing. And because of the idea that a colorblind person might pick up the pencil and not actually understand what the color was, she took all the color out of the coatings of the pencils and turned them white, and then labeled each pencil with the name of the color that it was. And you could think, oh, that's really smart at first, but in reality, it actually makes it more difficult for somebody with good color vision as well, because you've kind of removed an extra, key in the legend of choosing a color.
So
But it
accessibility
also makes,
shouldn't mean removing something.
yeah, like it's more about adding to something. Like if you'd taken those same pencils and made sure that all those pencils had the color names on them, then that's great because you're adding to it. You're giving everybody two pieces of information to work with. So you're not going to just be picking up a pencil and looking at it and being like, oh, okay, this looks like a red pencil, when it could be, orange or anything else. And if you just simply made sure that that pencil had a clear name on it, then you're making it easier for people who are not colorblind, and you're making it easier for people who are colorblind, because colorblind people are not, they don't see in shades of gray unless it's a very, very small, rare part of the population. Most colorblind people can see some color,
Right.
so you're taking away all information from them and making it difficult. So it's the same thing I've seen on the internet, on certain websites. If you're searching for clothing and you want to sort your clothing search in a search filter by,
Right.
I want to look for all pink shirts.
Right.
So many
That's
websites
me.
these days, so many websites these days, they don't have actual color swatches on that. They might just have like a white block with a little black outline and
And
then
a
the
name
name of the
that
color.
I don't even
Yeah.
know what I don't know what tangerine is.
Yeah, like what's tangerine? It's like, that could be obvious to somebody who speaks English. But, you have to think about everybody. It's really complicated.
Especially I think these companies that make sort of preppy clothes where everything's like there's like five shades of beige,
Oh
basically, and they
no.
give them five different names that mean like sand, wheat. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if sand is really my color or wheat. Like, how would I possibly? I mean, admittedly, even when they have color photography, it's a problem because it's not really how it's going to look in your home or on the street of your city. It's going to look different than it looks in a printed catalog where it's been, the limitations of color printing, and an art director adjusted the color palette, and you know, all the stuff. There is no reel.
Yeah, of course.
But it would still help a lot. Totally.
I feel like we need to use more clear names, more like accepted color names. Like if it's blue, call it blue. Like try to stick to the hue name. Like if you're talking about colors in a rainbow, so you know, don't talk about pink being cotton candy. Like that is such a common thing that I've seen in colors of like not just clothing but anything. Like
I think the copywriters, the marketing folks do that because, well, the copywriter, it's justifying their salary, and the marketing person thinks, you know, cotton candy sounds more, our demographic responded to that word more than pink. I don't wear pink.
It's true. But, yeah, true.
So you're always balancing. There's always a tug of war with all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think simple is, and straightforward is, it's better, much better to err on that side. In a way, what you're talking about reminds me of when I first started designing websites. We did what we thought of as very creative navigation. You know, like talk to the captain. Enter the galley, visit the poop deck, right? And then later we realized that it's actually probably better to say like white papers, leadership profiles. You know, I mean, boy, that's boring, but help people find what they're actually looking for. Like we were talking about writing earlier, I find that kind of straightforward titles, where it's clear what it's about, I don't mean clickbaity, but just where it's clear what you're writing about, do a better job of attracting readers on the very busy internet that has billions of articles and millions of people searching. Yeah. And if you have a, you know, if you have a like a lyric from a David Bowie song and it's poetic, and by the time the person gets to the end, they realize why you probably named your article that, that's great, but maybe people won't find it. I think it's the internet, and part of accessibility is just being transparent, honest, straightforward, simple, where we can be, where it makes
Absolutely.
Sense to
me. Absolutely. It just reminds me of one of my biggest pet peeves in the world right now, and that is if you look for a recipe on the internet, you basically are subjected to the person's life story of how their grandmother made it for them, and you know what they did during the time that they would eat this food, and you would have to scroll through like probably, I don't know, like 10 paragraphs in order to get to like the ingredients section. And like, I know, like, it's a similar thing. Like, people are making it so difficult to just access the information that people want to find. Like, I don't mind reading about that stuff if you maybe have it later, like after the recipe, but it's a similar thing, like content and names of these colors, and just try to reduce the number of frustrations. Like, just because you think that it's interesting or cool or funny, or, you know, cotton candy is an attractive name, you just have to think about what the customer is trying to do on your website.
That's interesting. It makes me think of my proposals in my studio. When we write proposals, like everybody else, we put the cost toward the end because we don't want to lead with it. We don't want to say, give us $1 million. We want to say like, imagine your website working better or whatever. Obviously that's bad. Like, but sometimes I think I should just put the price right up front in big red letters, like huge, like right in like Franklin Gothic condensed black.
Yeah. Right, I think on my quotes. I think on my quotes, I put them on the first page now, and then I just be like, "For this, this is what you'll get," and then like everything else comes later. But proposals are a tough one. Proposals are a tough one because I do know
you are storytelling. You are.
It's yeah.
To differentiate, because you're basically saying, we've actually studied what you folks do, and we've thought deeply about it already. And we think that some of the things that we do are a good match for things we believe you'll need to do. Mm-hmm. And here's how we propose to find out what else you need to do. Oh, and by the way, here's the price range. As opposed to, you know, MasterCard or Visa.
Yeah. I think proposals are a little different because it's kind of expected in the industry, too, that If you're putting out all these proposals, a lot of people want creativity as well, and they kind of expect it.
But they all skip to the end.
They
They
do skip
all
to
skip to
the
the end.
Yep.
Yeah, so, oh, speaking of transparency and skipping to the end, we're nowhere near the end, but we are near a commercial break. So please give me a moment. And I would like to thank our sponsor today, ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter. So I know that a lot of super high-powered executives are listening to this podcast right now. They need to find the best candidates for their jobs, and they don't know where to look. Well, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 job sites with just one click, and then they match the right person to your job better than anyone else. They do this with powerful technology, how we do everything. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails, no calls to your office. Screen, rate, and manage candidates in one easy place with the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard. Pretty cool, right? Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, Big Web Show listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, absolutely free. You've got a job, you're looking for somebody, go to ZipRecruiter and post for free as a thank you for listening to the Big Web Show. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. And now we are back with Hello Jerry. Let's talk about implementation and creating a color game plan.
Yeah. So one of the questions I think that a lot of people have when, they learn about color accessibility, and some people read my first book, and that's great. There's a lot of tips that I would give about, using contrast simulators, using contrast compliance checkers, all that sort of thing. But like, how do you actually put it together? And of course, it's going to vary based on your organization structure and how your team works. But, as a general sort of workflow, I think that it also depends on, if you've got like an existing color already, like if your branding is already there and you know that you're going to use it, then your use of color and how you're going to integrate that might be a little bit different than, say, somebody who has a new website and you're responsible for coming up for color for a new brand and that sort of thing. So I like to start off with, like auditing the color, having a look at your current color palette if you have a website, so assuming you have one already, and just put every single color that you have on it, throw it in an Illustrator file, throw it in a little style sheet, whatever you want to do, and just see how many colors you have and your color combinations, how accessible they are, and what the color contrast ratios are of those. And it kind of reminds me, I think it was Nicole Sullivan. Like, she did like an audit or something for, oh, I can't remember which company it was, but there was like
Facebook, maybe?
100, yeah, was it like 100 shades of blue or something?
Yes.
It was something
Yes.
really
Long
off the
time
wall.
ago. Long time
Yeah,
ago.
yeah.
They're much more, I mean, yeah, because there were like 1,000 developers working on stuff and they all sort of picked a blue.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
she also developed, and also the CSS got really complicated because you'd list your blue and nothing would change, and you go, "Hey, okay," and so you'd start concatenating selectors, right? Like
Yeah.
you'd put like 50 selectors on something to get what you wanted, or and then write important. So, yeah, she's done some really great work in that area. How do you
Yeah.
test a color palette? What do you do with it, like yourself? Like, let's say you've just created a mood board or some style tiles.
Yeah.
Where do you go from there? What do to make sure that you're not, you know, hurting someone inadvertently?
So one of the things that I would do at that stage, if I've got like a mood board, I would think about how those colors might be used in the future. So it's kind of impossible to tell at the stage, especially if it isn't designed, but you know, there's certain places where you can start, and that would be text contrast and then button contrast. So take your colors, the colors of your mood board, and just kind of mock them up and, you know, put that color on a, say, a white background, and put your blue on another white background, and take all those same colors and create sample buttons. And then you can run them through a contrast checker. So take that text color and compare it to the color of the background and see how those ratios start working. And if you have color problems at this stage, then you're going to have color contrast problems in the website stage. Once you actually start implementing them, those colors are not going to go away. So if you can kind of start weeding those errors out here and colors that don't pass the contrast ratio, just the bare minimum, you know, this is where you need to focus your time.
You can't necessarily get a good, what I hear you saying is you can't necessarily get a meaningful result just from a mood board, but you don't have to go to a full-blown comp either. Kind of a modified style tile or a module if you're doing atomic design or something along those lines. Design certain elements, interface elements, or design certain, you know, partial interaction screens, and then run that through to see if that works.
Exactly, because you know you're going to have text on backgrounds, and you know you're going to have buttons of some form if you've got some kind of, you know, interface, and you're going to have certain elements, you know, never really change from one website to the next. So apply those colors to that, test them at that stage. If you've got problems, then you can kind of adjust them from there before you go ahead with them. And then at the end, you know, you can do another test and make sure that things haven't kind of fallen through the cracks, like, you know, how we're talking about, you know, a bunch of different developers working on the same project. They might not stick to the style guide perfectly. But if you do set these kinds of things up in the early stages, then you're going to minimize the amount of time you have to put into fixing things at the end, which is generally the most crucial part if you're trying to get something out the door and make a deadline.
Well, if you're building a pattern library as you go, then when you need another element like that, you just grab that pattern again and, you know, solve it once, implement it everywhere.
Yep, exactly. So, you know, one of the things that I like to use early on in the stage is I like to use Leaver's contrast checker to kind of check my pairs. But if you do have a problem with a color at that stage, there is a app or a service called Tanaguru Contrast Finder. So you can basically plug your color pairs in and it will output the closest colors that match those colors that are accessible. So it doesn't always work, because if you have really extreme kind of colors, or they're really not accessible or not even close to being accessible, the colors that it will output will probably be very drastically different from the ones that you had in mind. But, you know, still, if you do that up front, even before you go to the client and say, hey, this is our proposed color palette for the website, you know, if they haven't seen it yet, then just use that opportunity to get it accessible and aesthetically pleasing before showing them. And it's just going to make your life a lot easier down the road.
That is great. That is great. I have one more sponsor to thank, and then we're going to have some closing thoughts. Okay. This edition of the Big Web Show is sponsored by User Interviews. User Interviews is the easiest way to find participants for user research studies. And boy, can I relate to this problem. If you're not user testing when you're designing stuff, then you basically are user testing. You're just user testing on a finished site with, you know, lots of live customers expressing their dissatisfaction. User testing is always the way to go. But finding the right people to do it can be hard. That's why User Interviews is a great service. It costs $20 for completed interview plus participant incentive. No back and forth emails. You just go to the website, fill out the form, and they start sending you participants. You can fill studies within 3 days, and it works for both remote and in-person interviews. You can even create custom screener questions to help get specific audiences. User Interviews is used by researchers and product managers at companies like Pinterest, Pandora, Nielsen Norman Group, Wayfair, and more. Those are companies that kind of know what they're doing. They will look for almost all audiences except for specific occupations, children, and medical conditions. Reasonable enough. So visit userinterviews.com/bigwebshow, and they will waive the sourcing fee for your first 5 interviews. Again, that's userinterviews.com/bigwebshow, and they will waive the sourcing fee for your first 5 interviews. User Interviews, the easiest way to find participants for user research studies. Okay, and we are back with Jerry Cody. Hello, Jerry on the Twitters, author of Color Accessibility Workflows. Jerry, have you ever in your years of doing this had a client whose brand colors just could not be made accessible? They just unfortunately had picked colors that absolutely were not going to work.
I would say only in the logo.
Yeah.
And that is kind of a different case. Like, you can convince a client that, you know, even if their branding colors that they chose probably aren't very accessible, that does not mean that you can't have accessible versions of those colors that are still going to look good with their branding.
Yeah.
On their website. So I feel like that's not really a good excuse.
Those can also be very supplemental, right? Like if you have
exactly.
these 5 colors that don't work for some people, but you make it a thin color strip along the side that's just purely decorative, then maybe that's a case where, you know, you can get away with using their colors or colors that are closer to their colors, even if they don't perfectly render. But if they're asking you to use them for the typography, then they have a problem.
Exactly. So it's just, you know, it's all things that you have to think about as a designer, and there's ways to make things accessible, and you can find a good compromise with the client.
So this book that you've just written, Color Accessibility Workflows from A Book Apart, is in A Book Apart Brief, and A Book Apart writes brief books, produces brief books for people who make websites. Briefs are even briefer. One of the nice things about a book like this is that it only has to contain the essential information. There's no fluff. It doesn't have to fill a specific width on a bookshelf in a bookstore. So it is only as long as it needs to be, right? It's only as many notes as Mozart needs to write, and no more notes than that. Did you find this is your second book, right?
Yes.
Did you find the experience tough going? Did you find writing a book brutally lonely and hard, or how was the experience for you?
I think the experience was brilliant because, you know, having great editors and a great team is really part of the whole thing. It's such an important thing, but I'm so passionate about the topic. It's just something I want to share with people, and I want to share it with as many people as possible. It's not just designers. It's not just developers. You know, if I could give a copy of this book to, like, some of my past bosses who are designers or developers, you know, maybe they might understand why accessibility matters. And that kind of thing is what got me really pumped up to write this book and to write about this topic. I just want as many people to understand it. And I think that's the key with accessibility, not just color accessibility, any accessibility topic. Everybody needs to understand why it's important, because if you've got some friction, you've got a greater chance of it not being implemented. So I think it's important for everybody to understand.
Fair enough. Do you feel like writing another book anytime in the future?
I don't know. I have thought about it, maybe something more on like broader color maybe, but I think right now I might focus on my side project for a while and see where that takes me.
Let's hear about that again. Is there anything you can tell us?
Yeah, I can share that it's called Jerry Draws Japan. It's going to be a travel blog and kind of goods, like I'm doing pins, I'm doing illustrations and art prints, I'm doing like embroidered patches, but I'm also going to have a travel blog as well, talking about my travels to Japan and things that I love about Japan with a big illustration kind of focus. So it's not going to be all photography like every other travel blog in the world. It's going to be more illustration and hopefully a little bit more unique. So
That sounds really. I have an unfinished blog from my first time in Turkey because that place blew my mind so much. But it's old, and I didn't illustrate. I sort of collaged, if that makes sense.
yeah.
But yeah, just to like give more depth to the story that you're telling.
Yeah.
Well, with your illustrations, it should be really beautiful. And Japan, I mean, the culture, the climate lends itself so much, the history, the multi-thousand year art history of that
Yeah.
country lends itself. It sounds really interesting. Do you go there a lot?
I've only been there twice so far, but it's been a, I would say, most of my life kind of interest and hobby. So I'm going again next year, and it's just something that at this point in my life, I have the opportunity to travel there a bit more, and I'm making this part of what I would like to do on the side. So, I'm learning the language, and I'm quite determined. It's the kind of thing where, I wish I'd started and stuck with it when I was in high school, because I always picked the book up, and I would study for a week and then I would give up. But this time it's working, so.
But it's great that you're doing it now. And, I know people in their 60s who are learning new things.
Exactly.
It's just, it doesn't matter. We
It
have, all of us have today.
yeah, and people say that, of course it's easier to learn a language when you're younger, and I
That's true.
think that is true, but at the
Definitely.
same time, if you are determined enough to do it, then it will happen, and it is I have seen noticeable progress in the past couple of years, so I just have to keep it up, which I know I will, because I'm at the point now where I've learned too much to actually quit.
This is fantastic. The name of this book is Color Accessibility Workflows. The name of the upcoming blog, Jerry Draws Japan. If we're looking for announcements about Jerry Draws Japan, we can look for them on Twitter at Hello Jerry, and that's spelled HelloGeri. Jerry Cody is the author, Geri Cody, Coady. And you can also find her at HelloJerry.com. Where she shares illustrations, design portfolio, photography, blog posts. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Jerry, I want to thank you today for being on the Big Web Show, and I hope we'll get to do it again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for writing this book, Color Accessibility Workflows.
Thank you for letting me write it, because it's
Oh.
just been a pleasure.
No. Thank you for writing it, period. And thanks, everybody. We'll be back with another Big Web Show. Bye-bye.